Hi and welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is a series of, it's a good start, this is a series of short stories about my 28 year career in the UK police force. Hope you've been enjoying it so far. If you've been before, and if not, welcome. If this is your first time, you might want to start from the first episode, as this is now episode 79. Seems quite surprising. Not ideal recording conditions today, and I hope the sound will be okay for you. Fingers crossed, we'll see how it goes. It's Christmas Eve, and I'm still here in Portugal in the camper van, so I'm not too far from a main road as well, so I'm hoping you won't get it too much, but you'll have to bear with me. So thanks very much for the downloads for the last week. Very good again, really good, and some nice comments on the various social media platforms. I don't know if you've seen the Facebook page as well, Police Stories Podcast, but some not so nice comments on there. But the reality is, you know, that's it. You know, as we've discussed many times, a lot of people don't like the police and what it represents. So their level is that they'll go on and make comments and derogatory comments and what have you. It's, you know, it's what I've had throughout my career, and yeah, no problems at all. There's no bad feedback, apparently. But okay, this week then we're going to talk about, we'll see how it goes, but maybe two or three different things. We're going to start off with one which was a missing person again. So I'm back on the streets, as you remember, in uniform, working for Police Scotland in a small town on the west coast of Scotland. We got called to reports of a missing person. Neighbour hadn't seen the guy who lived next door, you know, for a week or two, I don't think. And after a while, they called it in to us. And what normally happens is, certainly when people used to get, you know, milk delivered to their doorstep, you'd find that, you know, the milk would sort of build up on the door, or people would notice that there was letters, you know, sticking out through the letterbox. Or the classic sign, particularly in the summer, unfortunately, was people would say there's a bad smell, or, you know, they'd seen a lot of flies at the window, which, of course, is always you know, a bad sign potentially. So we went to this address. There was some checks we did on this guy first, sort of basic checks that you do for any missing person. We looked to see if he was on any of our systems, which he wasn't. Then the next check for sure is a hospital check, you know, a quick phone call or a pop up to the local hospital, because, you know, they may well have been taken in for some condition or something. And then obviously, you know, the neighbour wouldn't necessarily be aware of that. So you try and do as much sort of digging as you can before you actually go to the address, because sometimes, you know, you just can't get in, or you might have to force entry, which is not necessarily a problem, although, you know, we're not going out of our way to damage people's doors and things. So we'd done all our checks as much as we could, and we'd not really turned up any reason. This guy, he wasn't that old. I think he was about 60 or so, in reasonable health from what we understood. You know, there was no sort of underlying medical conditions or anything like that. And we went to his address and found the door ajar from memory. Or certainly, I think it was maybe closed but not locked. And that wasn't actually that unusual, given where we were in that sort of location. You know, it's quite rare for people to lock their doors still. You know, it's quite a low crime area. There's bound to be a crime spree now, I've said that obviously, but generally, you know, there isn't high crime, and quite often it's quite an old-fashioned place, and people, you know, leave doors unlocked. And particularly in Scotland, I've noticed they have storm doors, so they have outer doors on their front door, which then creates like a porch effectively before you get to their inner front door. And quite often, even when the weather was terrible, those outer storm doors would be left open, sometimes not just unlocked, but literally wide open. And the reason I was told for that was, you know, for travellers, it goes back, you know, it's quite a nice quaint thing, but for travellers of old, you know, that were out on a very stormy night and needed shelter, then basically by leaving those storm doors open, you're inviting someone just to get out of the weather, you know, for a short period of time behind those storm doors. And you'd be surprised how many, you know, people still did that. You know, I never actually saw anyone sheltering in them, but, you know, it was a nice idea. So we went to this address. It was a flat, from memory. It was a first floor flat. So we got the neighbour who'd called us to buzz us in the exterior. And then we went in, and I think there were stairs ahead of us straight up to this sort of first floor flat, which in fact was top floor because it was only two floors. And we found the door, as I say, unlocked, but closed too. So we gained entry reasonably easy. Now, there was no nasty smells or anything like that, and we had a very quick sort of glance around, and obviously a shout out before we went in, because it might just be the person's in there, you know, and they haven't heard us coming. But there was nothing obvious at all, and no signs of a disturbance. The door was secure in that there was no signs of a forced entry. You know, the lock wasn't broken. Again, these are things we're sort of looking for. I think there was one more neighbour upstairs, and we kind of knocked the door and had a chat with them just to see if they'd seen or heard anything sort of unusual. And they basically said the same thing, you know, not seen him for a couple of weeks or so. So we started to do a search around the flat. And we went from room to room. I think it was only a two-bed flat maybe, so there wasn't a lot to it. My colleague sort of went one way off down the corridor, and I went the other way. And no sign of anything. And say, no smell. So we were reasonably confident, you know, at that point, based on smell, that he wasn't there. So that was good. And then as we walked in, or as I walked into the bedroom, as soon as I pushed the bedroom door, I realised there was going to be an issue, because the bedroom door felt exceptionally heavy. You know, I almost had to sort of, you know, push it with my shoulder to open it. And having been in this scenario probably half a dozen times at least in my career, maybe more, I realised what was probably, you know, occurring. And sure enough, then on the round sort of door handle, I could see a relatively thin piece of nylon rope that had a loop around it, around the door handle, and it went up and over the top of the door and back down the other side. And it was very taut. And when I then stepped the other side of the door, in fact, you couldn't get to the door initially because it was closed on itself. It had sort of swung open, if you like, when I'd pushed it. So I got round the other side of the door and found the male who had hung himself. He'd committed suicide and hung himself. Very sad to find that. I still don't know really why he wasn't smelling that much, because we've talked about death and, you know, bodies quite a bit, and generally they do have, you know, quite a smell to them. But in this case, there was nothing, and he'd been there for a couple of weeks or so. So I called out to my colleague and said, you know, I found him, he's just in here. And I think because I was relatively matter of fact about it, she expected him to be, you know, sat up in bed with the flu or something, you know, and that he was just feeling a little poorly, you know. And she kind of came around the corner and was like, well, where is he, you know? And I said, he's just around the side of the door, you know. And she stepped round the back of the door and was, I think, a little bit surprised that I'd been, you know, relatively calm and laid back about the whole thing, because I'm afraid I was pretty used to it at that point. And so at that point, the things we were interested in particularly is the knot that was tied around the throat. That's always very important, and quite often we take photos of those. And in fact, what they've done in Police Scotland, and a lot of forces do this now, is they'd issued out the PDAs. They're basically big mobile phones that have, you know, all the capabilities phones have, so you can take photos, and more importantly, you can access a lot of the police systems on them. So people imagine that you're sitting in the lay-by, you know, playing a game, but the reality is I can write a statement on my phone, I can, you know, fill out all sorts of paperwork just on my phone without having to return to the NIC, which is a really good resource. So we use the camera sometimes, and I was able to take photos, close-up photos of the knot around this guy's neck. Very important. And because clearly, you know, life was extinct, as we were saying, you know, he was very dead. It wasn't like he was fresh, warm to the touch, and this was something that just happened and I'm about to start CPR. You know, he was absolutely stone cold, and you can tell from the colour of him that, you know, he'd been there a while. So we didn't feel the need to cut him down and start CPR or anything. So we informed the supervisor, which is pretty standard stuff, the sergeant. And then he came out as well to the location. And then really we're gathering evidence for, in Scotland, the procurator fiscal, or down south, the coroner, because there will now be an inquest into this person's death. for a ruling, which, you know, in this case was, as you'd expect, suicide. But we looked round the address, and I think eventually we found there was various medication. It was all quite neat, you know, there was no sort of sign of, as I say, anything sort of untoward happening there. And then screwed up in one of the bins, we found several scrawlings that were sort of purporting to be suicide notes explaining why he'd done it. I think he'd maybe tried to write them maybe two or three times, but hadn't actually got to complete them for whatever reason. But it just gave us a bit of an insight. And from memory, I think he had a serious illness, possibly cancer. And he, you know, he feared what was coming, so he decided to take his own life. So it's quite a sad case, as they all are. And then it was around about this time that we started hearing rumblings through, you know, sort of the big bosses at work, the higher up, the higher ranking officers. And this was a time where COVID had started and was looming, you know, it was getting worse. We'd seen it in Italy, we'd seen it spreading throughout Europe. And, you know, initially it kind of, I don't know about you, but I saw it on the news and saw what was happening in Italy and thought that's terrible, but it'll never happen here, you know. And I don't know why I thought that, you know, just naivety, I guess, on my part. But obviously we saw it spreading throughout Europe and some lockdowns going in place. And then we started hearing a few whispers through the grapevine at work that, well, that's not impossible, that could happen here. And it still seemed, well, literally impossible to me, you know, that that could actually happen here. But sure enough, as it got closer and closer, we had about 24 hours notice that something was going to happen, probably a lockdown across the country. And there was a bit of a, not a panic, you know, but there was a certain amount of work being done in relation to getting hold of PPE. I mean, luckily, you know, all police forces have a lot of PPE in terms of face masks, gloves, at the time kind of what I'd call a socko suit, you know, a white scenes of crime suit that with a hood that you zip up and things. And we weren't really sure if that was going to be needed. Then there was talk that everyone would have to be face fitted for a specific type of mask called FFP3, which was, you know, better than just the sort of paper mask that we all had to wear. But then they also said that really for full effect you'd need to be clean shaven. So again, there was a sort of ruling brewing that all officers that had beards, which included me, you know, that we would have to shave and be clean shaven. And there was a few moans and grumbles about that, which was surprising really, because, you know, given what was happening around the world and in this country, in the UK, it was the least of my worries, quite frankly. Now, my wife worked in the NHS and she was a radiographer, which is the person who carries out x-rays, amongst other things. And of course, she had seen a huge increase in chest x-rays required. So very much she was ramping up at work as well, and being called on for more and more chest x-rays. And she was seeing, you know, people coming in very seriously ill that she knew were unfortunately eventually dying. So it was not lost on both of us, you know, just how serious this situation was. And sure enough, obviously we all sat there and watched Boris give the news to the country that you know, there was going to be a national lockdown and that the whole country was going to be locked down. And of course we immediately knew somebody's got to enforce this, and who is that going to fall to? Well, clearly the, you know, the police, simple as that. You know, there was talk of the army, and maybe if it got out of control the army would have to come in and enforce it, and, you know, so that we could get on with normal police work. But how was that going to work realistically? And of course this was completely new ground. No one had any ideas just how it was going to work, basically, or if it was going to work. So lots of laws were rushed in. And I know you'll be aware of this, but I'm just telling it from the police side of things. You know, lots of new laws were rushed in, and which got really confusing. We almost had to have daily briefings specifically about what was and wasn't allowed. You know, we could barely keep up with it. So how members of the public that were relying on, you know, Facebook and various other unreliable sources to figure out what they actually were allowed to do. You know, this family unit and bubbles, and you can meet one person and you can only travel X amount of miles from your house, and initially you couldn't go out, and then you could, you know, go within a local distance, of course. Well, what was a local distance? You know, and it just, you know, it got very, very difficult to police. But one thing we did have to do, of course, was work, you know, absolutely flat out full time. There was loads of people called in on overtime because it, you know, very much caught people on the hop in terms of the resources it would take, because it created a lot of work. Initially, we were thinking, well, maybe there won't be too much work for us, you know, because everyone will be inside. Unfortunately, of course, that wasn't the case. Initially, I think for the first maybe week, the whole country was in shock and there was no extra work. And in fact, it was very, I'll use the Q word, quiet. Nothing happened at all, really, because, as I say, everyone, you know, the whole country was getting used to what was happening and obviously pretty much in shock at what we were seeing on the news, etc. But it slowly developed. And much as we see at, well, this time of year, Christmas, particularly, things like domestics, you know, arguments between partners, husband and wives, gets very much worse. And I think it's that pressure cooker environment. You know, people are stuck together. You know, normally they go off and see friends and do things, but now they're stuck together in the same house. Quite often drinking and alcohol is involved. So people would, you know, get out and, were drinking at home, you know. And of course, immediately we had, you know, the rule breakers that, and all the various conspiracy theorists that sort of popped up to tell us that, you know, it was the government were, you know, it was their way of reinforcing their grip on us, you know, and there was actually no virus, and all the anti-vaxxers came out, you know, it became very, very silly in a lot of ways. Yeah, so to start with, not too bad. And then certainly in Scotland, and particularly where I was working, there was a lot of holiday homes that were owned by people generally from down south, you know, London and the home counties, you know, had little cottages tucked away in remote, you know, Scottish villages that were very quaint and had nice, you know, sea views or lock views. And what they decided to do, thinking they would be clever, was the moment the lockdown happened, they thought, well, I can either sit in central London with 8 million other people, you know, sort of fighting in the supermarkets to get hold of, you know, a dwindling amount of food and toilet paper. If you remember that one, toilet paper started running out, then it was a run on toilet paper. So that became like gold dust, and you couldn't get hold of that. So they thought, rather than doing that, I'm going to get myself up to the Highlands. I'm going to get myself off to my holiday home that's, you know, tucked away in this little village in remote Scotland, and I'll just keep out of the way. You know, there's not so much virus up there, which was true. We did have it, but it wasn't as bad as down south, certainly in the area I worked in. And also, you know, they thought that that's fine, I'll just sort of, you know, keep tucked out of the way. But very quickly we saw what was happening, and new rules are brought in that you had to stay in your home of residence. Now, in these small villages, you know, it's a community and everyone knows, you know, who lives there and who doesn't live there. And invariably, the locals knew straight away, you know, that, you know, the house on the corner was a holiday home owned by somebody in London who came up, you know, three or four times a year or at Christmas or whatever it was. So the moment they started turning up en masse, and they were literally en masse for all these second homes, they were straight on the phone to us to tell us. And initially there was no rules against it, but that very quickly changed when it was obvious what was happening, because of course these villages that may only have, I don't know, 100 residents suddenly had 150 residents, and those 100 residents that lived there, of course, were relying on the little local shops that carried, you know, very little, just your basics, and of course they were struggling to get stock like everywhere else was. And so you suddenly, you know, swell the population by an extra third of that village, and the little amount of food and toilet paper, you know, that there is to go round, was vastly reduced. And of course, it was causing for sure some angst, you know, amongst the locals, and a certain amount of animosity as well. And of course, we were getting the phone calls. So then for the next, you know, several weeks, if not months, we spent our time going round to those local villages where, you know, they called us, the residents, and said, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Bloggs from London have come up here and are staying in their holiday home on the corner. You know, they do not live here. So then we end up with this ridiculous sort of cat and mouse game, where we would go around and knock on the door, you know, and they wouldn't answer, so we'd have to go back. And these villages, you know, were remote, so they might take us an hour to get out to the villages, and we might drive all that way to find, you know, they're not going to answer the door. So we ended up having to be like a bit sneaky, you know, and going out at different times and seeing if you know, lights were on, and walking around into people's back gardens and things to catch them out. And basically, and then even when, you know, they answer the door, some people would just accept it and go, okay, fine, yeah, I know, you know, we'll leave. And others would say, no, you know, I live here. They try it on basically. No, I live here, you know, this is my home address. And you'd be like, oh, great. If you can just show me your council tax then. And then you'd also do some checks on the cars that were on the driveway. And of course, they'd be registered at the same address down in London. And then they couldn't produce, you know, a council tax in their name, or you'd ask to see their driving license, which would be the same address that the cars are registered. And you'd be like, look, clearly you don't live here. The residents know you don't live here. You're putting a massive strain and pressure on these local shops. You're going to have to go back to your, you know, your proper residence, your home address in London. It's just not fair. And I have to say, of all the people we spoke to, and there was a lot, there was only one or two that really didn't like what we were telling them and really tried to wriggle out of it, and that we had to kind of threaten with fines and, in one case, arrest eventually, because he immediately started getting very aggressive. So regardless of the reason, you know, if he was going to get aggressive with us like that, he was going to get himself arrested anyway. But it didn't come to that, and I personally didn't have to issue a fine. You know, a couple of stern words, a bit of a warning, and that was enough, really, and those people were on their way. But that took up a lot of our time and work. And then it changed slightly when they opened it up to, you know, where you could go camping, you know, and you could be outdoors, you know, you could walk your dog and all that sort of business. Again, it came in with this, you know, this range, this within 5 miles of your house. So then you were trying to establish ridiculously, you know, well, where do you live, you know, and then is that 5 miles as the crow flies or by the road, you know? So the onus was on us, you know, and hopefully a big dose of common sense came in. But we started to see camper vans when it eased a bit and people were allowed to travel. We started to see camper vans coming up, particularly even down south again, to all these remote spots with a similar, you know, point of view, that they wanted to be out of the way. And they sometimes, you know, quite often brought their own food, so they were self-sufficient to a degree, but it wasn't really playing by the rules. And we regularly had to visit these various sort of, you know, sneaky campsites that we knew, various laybys and woods and things that had car parks in, and unfortunately moved those people on as well, you know. But the classic was, you turn up at night and you say, look, you've got to go, and straight away they'd say, well, I've had a drink, I've had a couple of beers, you know. And of course, if someone, we weren't going to muck about, start breath testing people and saying, oh no, you're okay to drive, because there's issues with that. Because if they've just had a drink, even if you waited 20 minutes, sometimes the alcohol level can rise still. So, you know, they might blow under the limit with you an hour down the road because they've had quite a bit to drink. They're now over the limit. And can you imagine the nightmare scenario where they get stopped by another cop who breaths them and says, you're over the limit. And they say, well, you know, that other cop said I could drive and he breath tested me and I was all right, you know. So it just was griefy. Invariably, the common sense option was to say, okay, stay tonight, but you must go tomorrow. If you're still here tomorrow when I come back, I'll be issuing you a fine, you know. And again, for me personally, that's all it ever took, you know. So people moved on. And all I kept seeing frustratingly on the news and the paper and everyone I ever spoke to and saw a lot of myself on social media was that, oh, lockdown, I'm so bored, I wish we had something to do, oh, I can't wait to go outside and breathe the fresh air, I just want to get out, I just want to do something. And I guess if I was in the same scenario, I probably would have felt the same. But unfortunately, I was flat out working, you know, we were busier than ever, quite often being asked to do 12-hour days or nights, working extra hours. My wife was the same, back-to-back chest x-rays. So the pair of us had never worked harder, you know, we'd never done so many hours. And, you know, to top it off was all these people moaning of how bored they were stuck at home. And we were thinking, we'd love to be stuck at home. Why can't we just sit at home like everyone else and do nothing, you know? But somebody had to get out there and you know, keep things going. And of course, it was, as virtually everything is at the police, you know, very unpopular in sometimes, particularly when you were dealing with your anti-vaxxers, etc. We had a few more serious incidents as well. We had fairly early on, our sort of SOP, our standard operating procedure, if you like, was somebody who we believed had COVID, then we were to get suited up, you know, in a full white Socko suit with an FFP3, you know, mask and hood up and gloves and all this business, which was a nice idea. And of course, it was the Rolls Royce of, you know, looking after ourselves, but highly impractical because it took time. But we did have a call fairly early on that there was a guy who kind of weaponized COVID, and that he said, I have COVID, you know, I've got it really badly. And he was walking around on the seafront, basically threatening that he was going to infect people and infect everyone. You know, there was definitely some mental health at play. So that was the one occasion that we were tasked to go down and deal with this guy. So myself and my colleague, there was already some cops on the scene who didn't really have any protection apart from the thin paper mask on, and they were just trying to keep a distance and engage with this guy. We went round the corner, got suited up, put on these full white suits, and basically came out of there looking like we'd, you know, just come from a murder scene, what with the white suits on and double gloves and, you know, taped up wrists and boots, you know. And it took forever, and eventually we went to deal with this guy, and he, you know, claimed to have COVID, although seemed relatively healthy. You know, he wasn't sort of coughing his guts up or showing any of the symptoms. And we basically put him in the back of our prison van and took him off to the hospital. Now, this is where it got really embarrassing, because the NHS staff that were doing all the dangerous stuff, dealing with proper COVID, you know, types that were very, very ill, because of the lack of PPE, they basically had a pair of gloves if they were lucky, and sometimes they didn't even have that, and a thin paper mask. And we turned up looking like we were on a one-way ticket to, you know, outer space, saying we got this person here who says they got COVID. And we knew all these guys and girls pretty well in the hospital, because obviously we were out there all the time. And they thought it was hilarious, you know. They were kind of like, what have you come as, you know? And yeah, we felt a bit stupid, to say the least. But anyway, we got over it. We got bit of Mickey taken out of us, and then carried on. But yes, it turns out he didn't have COVID at all. It was mental health. So, you know, we'd not come to any harm, thankfully. But certainly for the next few months, you know, any time you went to a job and somebody was getting aggressive with you, they'd invariably throw in the COVID card, you know, tell you they had COVID and that they were going to infect us, and that, you know, they would spit on us, etc. So some fairly unpleasant times for sure. And like most other people, you know, I got COVID during that time, and so did my wife eventually. Thankfully, we're both okay, but unfortunately, as we know, you know, thousands of others weren't. So we consider ourselves lucky given the roles that we had during that time. It was certainly, as it was for everyone, you know, a scary old time. And incredible, really, even to think back now that happened. And I can imagine, you know, sort of telling your grandkids about it in the future, I think it'll be really hard for them to believe and get their heads around, you know, we were locked down and this is what happened. But of course, they do say that, unfortunately, we may well be in that position again. So not the most cheerful thought, given particularly the time of year. But there we go. So a little bit shorter today, but I think that'll cover it. There's not really any point getting into any more incidents at this point. So I wish you a happy Christmas and a happy new year, and all the best. And we'll speak again soon. All right, take it easy. Cheers. Bye.